Hello, I'm Michaela Maguire, Artistic Director of Melbourne Writers Festival. You're listening to a conversation from our 2021 podcast series, which is supported by the Copyright Agency's Cultural Fund.
Hello and welcome. Thank you for clicking on this one of dozens of the podcast series from the Melbourne Writers Festival in 2021. In a moment, I will introduce our guests for Fortress Australia and the way this nation has dealt with COVID. I do want to pay my respects to the First Nations people whose land on which we all sit and meet and discuss. I am talking to you from the ABC studios, almost in the centre of Melbourne, and I am less than 1,000 metres from one of the most fascinating and potentially important parts of both modern Melbourne and ancient Melbourne as well. Really close to here is the place that used to be a ford across the river, Birrarung, now known as the Yarra. There was a rocky outlet. If you know Melbourne well, Elizabeth Street hits Flinders Street, and at about that point in the Yarra, that's where the river changed from salt water to fresh water. It was like a crucial coming together of four different environments. There's the forest on the hill, which we now know as the city of Melbourne. There's the marshlands and the wetlands stretching out to places like Albert Park and St Kilda, and it was where the fresh water from upstream met the salt water coming in from the bay. It was, as well as being a crucial geographic place, that's where the Kulin nations came together. If they wanted to meet and talk, swap stories, discuss what was going on in their lives, just as we do at a writers' festival, so many members of the Kulin nations for tens of thousands of years crossed at that point on the river. So with that, it's a great pleasure to introduce the people who are going to talk about how we have dealt with potentially the biggest event in for most of us in our lives. I'd like you to welcome Norman Swan. His latest book is So You Think You Know What's Good For You, The Ultimate Guide from Australia's Most Trusted Doctor. We're also joined by Osman Faruqi. He hosts the 7am podcast for Schwartz Media. And Jamila Rizvi is with us. Her book, Work, Love, Body, Future Women, is her latest tome. All of them are online and available to order at readings. Welcome to all three of you. Let me just set the scene. We are geographically lucky as a country. We shut up shop. We crushed COVID. The question today is whether or not the very popular hardline response camouflaged anything. Did it cover up a bungled vaccine rollout? Did it cover up the way some of our citizens were treated both here and overseas? And did it stoke xenophobic anxieties simply for the purposes of political gain? I want to start by asking all three of you if it was worth being a fortress. Osman Faruqi, I might start with you. We shut down a lot. We blocked a lot of people out of the country and out of their own home states. Do you think it was worth it?
It's a really, really interesting question. I think what makes it so challenging to answer is that on one hand, we kind of have more numbers and statistics than we ever have had before being presented to us, not just daily, but multiple times a day in terms of deaths, illnesses, hospitalizations. People, regular people like all of us here, are glued to these things in a way that we haven't before. We can see in real time how countries around the world have dealt with this virus and the impact that it's had. And on that metric, you know, I think it is not controversial to say that Australia has been one of the relatively well-off, lucky countries. We have not seen the kinds of deaths we've seen around the world. We have not seen the really traumatic and stressful scenes that we saw in countries in Europe, in the United States, at the worst points of this pandemic. But on the other hand, some of the trade-offs that we've made in order to have that safety, whether that's been things like closed borders for 2 years, whether that's been, you know, closed international borders or domestic borders, extended lockdowns, even though they've been vital in saving lives, the impacts of those are much harder to quantify. You know, there's no graph that shows the emotional or mental toll of what happens when families can't be reunited, or what happens when, someone with cerebral palsy isn't allowed to visit their parents because they happen to have an operation in the wrong state at the wrong time. So it maybe is a little bit of a cop-out, Raf, to say that because we can't quantify those things, it makes it really hard to compare those to the things that we can quantify. But I think the point that I would make in response to that question is that even if we all accept that Australia has managed to contain the pandemic relative to the rest of the world, I think some of the measures that we've taken in order to do that, And the two things that I think I'd point to the most are the extended long-term border shutdowns and the really, I think, uniquely in terms of the Western world, quite extreme way we policed our lockdowns have had consequences that need to be interrogated, need to be analyzed, and need to be weighed up as we emerge into this next stage of the pandemic. Because I don't think we should look at this and say, we contain deaths relative to the rest of the world. Therefore, our pretty extreme measures in locking out our own citizens and having military patrol parks and, you know, sending in the police to public housing towers, those sorts of things were worthwhile. I think that would be a really reductive conclusion for us to draw from the last couple of years here.
Yeah, the burden is not borne equally. I want to come back to some of those social measures. Jamila, what do you think? Was it worth it, everything we did?
The answer to that question depends on whether you take everything together or you take each measure individually, right? Because most certainly there were measures taken that were likely unnecessary in retrospect, that there were measures taken that created more harm than they did good. But I think if you collectively look at what Australia has achieved, I think Australia's still got a lot to be proud of when it comes to, and I mean Australians, not necessarily the Australian government. I think Australians have a lot to reflect on in terms of what they've done. I come to this and I can't help but coming to this from a personal perspective, and that's as someone who's severely immunocompromised. And I still feel, in a non-Pollyanna way, very grateful for what other people living in Melbourne have done for people like me. And the estimates, you know, which range from everything from 7,000 through to 150,000 potentially lives saved, I can't look at those numbers and say that it wasn't worth it. And yeah, it's been an incredibly tough 18 months. And for Work, Love, Body, my new book with Future Women, we talked to people who went through the most extraordinary hardship, you know, people who watched their parents die on Zoom, people who were separated from children in emergency rooms, people for whom their livelihoods were lost and their ability to go to work and feed their families as a result were compromised, nurses who have been through the most incredible toll ended up with COVID themselves and felt completely unsupported. At that individual level, we can see the shocking impact that it's had on so many people. But I think if we take it collectively, while there's a lot to unpack, I think Australia's achieved a great thing.
Norman Swan, was it worth it?
Like Osman and Jamila, holistically, yes. We've saved countless numbers of lives. We've saved countless numbers of people from long COVID. So that's the physical side of it. In states where they haven't had quite the same degree of lockdown as Victoria, economies have bounced back. And even the Victorian economy hasn't done as badly as people predicted. So the places in the world which have locked down quickly have done better economically. With more opportunity as it opens up. I think that what I concur with is that there is a loss of human rights, civil rights, as a result of what we've done. And I lay the blame for that at the clunky, inefficient federal bureaucracy. What this pandemic has shown is that at a federal level, the bureaucracies, and I use it plural, during this time have been exposed as ineffective. We could have had Chinese overseas students coming into our universities from early on in this pandemic. We had PCR testing. We were quite happy to have home isolation for people who are COVID positive. And yet we came up with hotel quarantine. We shut our borders to everybody unselectively. Could have had people from Singapore, Pacific Islands, Taiwan, Hong Kong. We could have selectively opened up very early with PCR testing. It would be required the federal bureaucracy to actually do some work. The technology that South Australia has developed for home quarantine is not new technology. It's geolocation, it's facial recognition. We could have done that then and had people quarantining at home for a while or in a dorm, and Australians could have come home. I think it is outrageous that we've shut our borders to Australians. Yeah, it can't be open slather to everybody from everywhere. We probably would have had a few cases coming in and had to deal with that. But the reality is we've denied our own citizens the right of return. And this right of return is extremely important. And I don't know what that's done for people's identification with this nation. And it's a clunky bureaucracy. It has not pivoted. And it actually disturbs me to see it across the federal bureaucracy. We couldn't bring out the interpreters and the people who assisted our forces in Afghanistan when we could have. we've done a deal with the United States without thinking through what it's going to do to our other geopolitical relationships and the health department. Lieutenant General Frewen needs to be Australian of the Year because he's fought against the health bureaucracy quite significantly along the way to get the vaccine rollout. So, the point that I've been making since the beginning is that politics causes pandemics. The germ is almost the least important part, and the aftermath will be the result of politics, probably more than the germ.
I want to get to the politics, but I want to address something Osman raised, which is it's the same with drug enforcement. If you do bulbs or smoke marijuana on the streets and you live in a poor area, you're much more likely to get picked up by the cops than if you sniff a white powder in an expensive club. We know drug laws are not enforced fairly across our socioeconomic areas. It's clear the fines were handed out in a similar way. I'm curious to know I might start with you, Norman, and then keep going around. Could that bit have been done better? Let's assume for the sake of this conversation, we're going to still have a pretty tough lockdown. Could it have been policed more equitably, Norman?
Yes, it could. And Victoria Police were particularly vicious, particularly early on. And you heard fairly aggressive language from the Premier. I'm talking about the second wave last year. And it took them a while to realise they needed to do things very differently in the Northwest Corridor and people who don't speak English as a first language at home. And they just did not do that well. Mm-hmm. Let me just put a historical context in this. Every pandemic in history has exaggerated the fracture lines between people, the haves and the have-nots, the disadvantaged and the people who have good education and have the ability to get through with better health and better well-being. And this is true of this pandemic as well. And what we lost early on was a sense of history and knowing that that would happen. And the people, no textbook of public health will have to be rewritten because of COVID-19. It's followed the same pattern as the Black Death, as syphilis, HIV, pandemics through history. And we could have anticipated this is what would have happened. And yes, we could have done things better. And we tend to focus on politicians and they lead the bureaucracy. I'm sorry to be hammering on about this, but the bureaucracies have got to take a share of the responsibility of this because they have not been flexible. They've been far more flexible at state and territory level than they have at federal level, but they've still not been as flexible as they should have been.
Norman and I are one on that. I think there should have been a lot more focus on the bureaucracy of the health department in Melbourne rather than which politician hired the security guards. But Osman, just to address the inequality of the policing, and also where do you think it leaves the communities who are over-policed? What's the long-term legacy of that?
It's a really important point Norman made. What we saw in response to this pandemic and what we should have done and the lessons that we're now raking over, none of these things are new. Like, there's only really two ways to respond to public health crises, and that's through, you know, having great public health systems and having a really strong, coherent level of trust between the community and the government. I think a lot of the mistakes that governments in Australia made were really set in stone early on in the pandemic, where rather than focusing on what we needed to do to build up our public health system and what we needed to do to build trust and connections with communities that we knew were going to be the most vulnerable, because as Norman said, they've always been the most vulnerable in every crisis, and we know who those people are, we know who those communities are. The Australian government at a federal level relied very heavily, and I would say almost exclusively, on border control as a way to mitigate the virus. And then at a state level, particularly in Victoria, but also I think in states that have been relatively COVID-free, like WA and Queensland, again, domestic border control, and in Victoria, really, really tough policing. And I think both of those things, the borders and the policing, masked a lack of willingness to invest in public health. And that might be, as Norman and you were saying, Raf, that our bureaucracies just went up to scratch. But I think it's also pretty telling that now, nearly 2 years into it, we've seen reports that we have fewer ICU beds now than we did at the start of the pandemic. To me, that is an immense failure of health planning. And so then that goes to, okay, so instead of doing the health stuff, we focused on borders and we focused on policing. The inequity, we don't talk about this as much as we talk about policing, but the border closures have also been deeply inequitable. The Senate has seen information that's been presented by the Department of Home Affairs that shows that far more exemptions were granted to places, countries, people traveling from Europe and the United States than people trying to return from India or East Asia. And that is completely disconnected to the rates of COVID in those countries at those points in time. So that inequity exists within our systems. It played out at the border level. And then at a state level, not only do I think was the policing overhanded, it was completely counterproductive. And I think that's what we're seeing now. When we're seeing after 18 months of a government blaming, no, I don't want to be too, like, I think the Victorian government, I think Norman is right, did recognize probably a little bit too late that its reliance on admonishing the population and policing was probably wrong, because in terms of getting through this for the long haul, you need to build trust, you need to be honest, you need to be transparent, you need to help people rather than send in the police. They did eventually realize that, but I think enough people now felt as though the government overstepped. They felt as though the rules didn't quite make sense, a lot of them, and they felt as though they were being unfairly justified. And I think that's kind of why in Melbourne we've seen the obvious drop off. Like, you live here, Raf, like the rules are not being held to the same standard that they were during the second wave. That will have consequences on people getting sick and potentially dying. And I think we are seeing that when you focus on policing rather than on trust, rather than on identifying those communities, the communities from non-English speaking backgrounds in particular that are at most risk and have least trust, you end up with this situation. So it's not even like a bleeding heart perspective that is, I don't like the police. I think you can leave that aside regardless of your views and how important policing is. If your goal is to limit cases and to suppress the virus, doing it in this way is completely counterproductive. And I think that's being borne out right now.
Jamila, what do you make of the legacy of the way we have enforced all of those rules?
I think there's a couple of points I'd make in terms of what both Norman and Osman have just said. The first one is that I look at Canberra, right? Not Canberra as in the political sense, but Canberra the city. You are talking about a city that exists within New South Wales, is so proximate to Victoria. It didn't have the distance that a Darwin or a Perth did, and yet has had remarkably few cases through this pandemic. The lack of leak of COVID from New South Wales to the ACT has been extraordinary through the vast majority of the pandemic, and really even in the last few weeks. And a lot of that is to do with the socioeconomic difference between Canberra and the rest of the country. You have a largely white, well-educated, high-income population. And I think what that proves to us is what Norman was saying earlier, that we should have known that this pandemic was going to impact some groups in our society more harshly than others, and we should have been prepared for that. I think it's interesting that, speaking to Canberra as well, that if we think to the public service, I think it was on 7am actually this week, Osmond, there was a discussion by Rick Morton around the whittling down of the public service in Canberra over the last decade and a half. There has been an extraordinary reliance on consultants over public servants with long-held institutional knowledge. You just don't have the guts to the public service there anymore. It's always been a slow-moving, in-responsive beast, and I think that's something that partly comes with bureaucracies. But certainly if you are losing your top talent, if you have got that brain drain happening and you are whittling down the public service, so you're really relying on the PwCs and the Boston Consultings, you're not going to have a public service that can pivot in any way to what you need it to. When it comes to how the pandemic has impacted different groups, particularly within Sydney and Melbourne, and particularly within the western suburbs of each city, I know that there have been multiple points in this pandemic when I have been really confused by government advice. And I have struggled to follow what's happening in the press conference. And then I've jumped online and struggled to follow the information that's been provided. And I know Sydneysiders have had the same experience at times. The rules have been complex. Accessing vaccines have been complex. And I am someone with all the privilege in the world. Plus, I work in the media, right? It should be easy. If you have English as a second language, if you don't read in English, and you're someone who has potentially migrated from a country where government intervention in your life has been terrifying in the past, where the presence of police on the streets is not something you associate with safety, but something you associate with danger, like, how on earth were you supposed to figure out what was going on?
Jamila, I'm going to come back to the politics of the pandemic. But Norman, you wanted to address something?
So two things, just bouncing off Jamila there. One is that it's not just the gutting of the civil service or the bureaucracy. It's that secretary level. They're political appointments. And there are people who are not necessarily up for the job and are obeying their political leaders. So we've lost the independence of a bureaucracy. And I think a lot of people, the morale in the health department, I'm told, is really low under, you know, at the middle level in the bureaucracy because they realize of all the compromises they've made. The second thing I will say is that, and it goes to that point that you're talking about, the confusion, Jamila, which is we've had this patina of transparency. So we have the premiers of each state and the chief health officer standing up and telling us we're following health advice. They're not following health advice. Mm. And if they are following a health advice, it should be transparent. We should know what it is because health advice should be based on science, and science is apolitical. So why do we have national secrets made of the expert advice that's given to the government from the infection control group, which clung to 50-year-old data on droplet spread rather than airborne spread? Why don't we know what the advice basis is for the principal health committee, ATAGI, and so on? What this has exposed is the Australian government's love of secrecy. And in these press conferences, I'm really not sure why we have them, because they're not transparent. They tell us what they want us to know, and people within the system are forbidden from talking. So you get very little from those in reality. They just serve, I think, to increase anxiety and don't really tell us anything particularly helpful.
Okay, I want to move things on if I can. Thank you for tuning into the podcast series from the Melbourne Writers Festival. We're talking about Fortress Australia, our nation's response to the pandemic. Jamila Rizvi, can I return to you? I'm really interested as a daily media participant and Twitter user myself. We have some frenzied debates that are intense on the day, everyone from the Twitter follower with five people to the national broadsheets. And then 3 months later, the conversations we've had may not be that relevant. I want to focus in on one, and I'm just interested to know your own personal interest in the New South Wales versus Victorian approach. It was intensely frenzied in the middle of the year. Were you interested in it? Was it important? And does it matter now?
The discussion of whose approach was the right approach and whose approach was the best approach fed our worst demons when it comes to state competitiveness, right? And for a lot of us, we were stuck at home and bored. And so it was like sport, was something to engage in on Twitter with the arguing with someone from New South Wales with five followers and wasting your time. Was it productive? Was it helpful? Of course it wasn't productive and helpful. I don't think state rivalries ever are. But when it comes to the actual approaches, I mean, I think right now, and I'm not going to pretend to understand the science the way Norman does, but I think right now there are a lot of Victorians who are looking at those numbers going up day after day and wondering when that peak is coming and comparing themselves to New South Wales and thinking, what? Like, what did we do wrong? I thought we were doing everything right. And I think there is a frustration and there is a sadness and there is a tiredness and just an exhaustion amongst Victorians, where I almost get the sense that the politics is being put away, because in the same way I'm just too tired to have the same fight with my husband again, I'm too tired to be grumpy at the government that my Sydney colleagues are going out to lunch and having a champagne and I'm still stuck at home homeschooling.
Oz, what do you make of that furious debate and what we learned?
I mean, I have found myself being caught up in it a lot. Like, I was doing a lot of reporting on the Victorian government and their policies and the questions around hotel quarantine, policing, all that sort of stuff, and was accused of being, you know, a shill for Gladys Berejiklian in New South Wales. My approach to this is pretty sanguine. It's that, as a journalist, your job is to hold powerful people to account and interrogate them. And sure, that might upset people. I think taking a step back, in a crisis, it's not a crazy idea that people will turn to the person that is in charge, right? And is standing up every day and saying, I'm going to protect you. So in a way, it's not that surprising that Victorians felt a sense of comfort in Dan Andrews being their guy, and it's not surprising that New South Wales people felt the same way about Gladys Berejiklian. And I think both leaders, to different extents, played into that, because it's domestically popular for them to say, you know, I'm looking up for Victorians and I'm going to pick on New South Wales, or vice versa. I think, though, it might have worked politically for those leaders, I think ultimately it masked what could have been more useful discussions about what were the similarities and differences going on in each state. And I think states are different. I think one of the biggest ironies of the whole New South Wales-Victoria divide is that why New South Wales in the early stage of the pandemic seemed to fare better than Victoria had very little to do with Gladys versus Dan. It kind of had more to do with the fact that Gladys inherited a public health system that was relatively well structured and resourced compared to Dan Andrews' public health system, which had been chipped away over decades and was essentially non-existent. You know, and during the second wave, Victoria had an entirely outsourced contact tracing team, while New South Wales's was devolved and full of public servants at a regional level. It sort of is kind of funny that that's become a partisan sort of question, even though Victoria, which is a Labor government, had that outsourced and defunct public health model and New South Wales. And that, again, like I said, has nothing to do with Dan or Gladys or Liberal versus Labor. It's just the circumstances as they were. I think you asked Jamila, Raph, like, does it matter now? I think that the sad irony of all of this is New South Wales and Victoria have essentially the same response to COVID at the moment. I think New South Wales kind of got there a little bit earlier, like a few weeks earlier, deciding that we can't suppress this virus, we can't eliminate it. The only way out is to vaccinate the population to a high level and then open up. Victoria was 2 to 3 weeks behind that, maybe 3 to 4 weeks behind that. And now we're in this kind of sad situation where we're back in lockdown and in lockdown for the next few weeks while we watch our friends in Sydney open up. But I think when we look at all of this in the wash in a few months or in a few years, I don't actually think this tension between New South Wales and Victoria will be that significant in terms of the lessons learned.
Just a footnote to the division, I still haven't established why there were 260 extra GP clinics handing out vaccine in New South Wales ahead of Victoria. I've interviewed the Health Minister, Greg Hunt, the head of the vaccine rollout, Lieutenant General Frewen, and I still don't understand why they had more taps to run the vaccine out. But anyway, I think you're right, Oz. It's going to be distant history. Norman, what did you learn? You were actually a pretty big part of that debate, and you were sort of asked to commentate about it, I guess, on TV most days. What did we learn about the New South Wales versus Victoria? Did we learn anything?
Well, I hope we've learned something. And I hope we've learned, and it comes to Osman's point about being a federation and there are variations between states. And we tend to get very parochial about the state that we live in and think it's the best in Australia and it's above criticism. Dan Andrews is not above criticism. 2009, during the flu pandemic, Victoria ran the white flag up and the flu pandemic stopped testing. We actually had to create a separate category under Dan Andrews because they didn't have the public health system to actually do that. In other states, they actually reformed their public health. But I do this, you know, I'm a national reporter. Yes, I live in New South Wales, but I have been for years frustrated at the arrogance in the Victorian health system. And it is arrogance. They've always believed that they've got the best system. They stuffed up health reform in 2007, 2008, because we've got the best system and we don't need to change. And just the point that Osman made earlier was the core reason why they didn't have a public health system is that you've got 85, 88, I lost count, of different little hospital groups, some very big like Royal Melbourne and the Alfred, but they don't look after populations. Whereas every other state in Australia looks after their population and it's organized around communities and populations. Victoria thought they were better than that. Now, it is going to change in Victoria, but I think that we all need humility, no matter where we live in Australia, that we're not right and we should be learning from each other. And no matter where you live in Australia, you've got the right to the same level of healthcare, the same level of outcomes, and we don't. We don't by ethnicity, we don't by postcode, and we don't by overall organization of healthcare. And it's patchy. And what we should learn is that we've got to come together for an equally high standard of healthcare. And I have to say that the Victorian health system has been the most resistant to change and the belief that they could actually improve. And hopefully moving forward, when we talk about cancer care, cardiovascular care, general public health care of people with disadvantage, that we learn from that and come together more as a nation and have truly a national healthcare system, because we don't at the moment.
Yeah, it would have been nice actually if the federal health bureaucracy had created some lessons learned. We might have had some vaxxed drivers in quarantine as well. But look, that's all the past. Before we finish, I want to know from the three of you, next time something like this happens, if there's one thing the pandemic's taught us, every big problem we've got in the world, be it 60 million people without a home around the world, climate change and pandemics. We need collective effort to solve collective problems. What have we learned from how well we worked together this time? And what does it tell us about how well we're going to deal with whatever the next big challenge is? Jamila, I'll start with you again. What do you think? Are we better prepared for the next pandemic or climate change or anything else we need to have a collective effort on?
Trying to be optimistic. I reflect now that the coronavirus supplement lifted, I think it was more than 600,000 Australians temporarily out of poverty. We spoke to someone for our Work Love Body book. Her name's Julie, and she is a single mum of two kids, and she says the coronavirus supplement changed her life. She said for the first time she could pay a rent. She paid her bills ahead of time, which makes them cheaper. She said the cupboards were full and she bought in bulk, which meant she could access discounts she never could before. And she said she felt so guilty because it took so many people dying to make that happen. And she couldn't get over how dreadful what she was seeing on the news was and the fact that she personally felt so relieved because for her, life got easier temporarily. So I hope that going into whatever next crisis befalls us, and I think we can all guess what it's going to be, I hope that we remember the people who are doing it tough and we remember that crises make the cracks that already exist even deeper and even worse. And we know who is going to be doing it tougher when the next crisis comes along. We already know, and we can put the work in now to put a better safety net in underneath those people.
And do you think that's going to happen though, Jamila? Because, you know, Scott Morrison's socialist utopia, that wasn't a joke last year. You know, we had free childcare and people on the dole got double what they used to get for JobSeeker, et cetera. Is that now baked in a little bit, do you think, to our bureaucracy and our politics or not?
No, I don't think so. How quick governments were to walk away from that support and walk away without that long-term transition. The fact that childcare workers were the first people that weren't getting JobKeeper and were back on the job again, you're talking about people who are mostly women, who are vastly underpaid and also highly educated. They've got university degrees and they're paid $45,000 a year, and those were the people we sent back to work first without JobKeeper. Yeah, I don't know if we learnt that much.
Osmond, what did we learn? How well prepared are we for the future?
I may be even more pessimistic than Jamila, but I'll try and talk through what I think are some of the positives. I think Jamila is right. Like, one thing we've learned is how easy it is to solve poverty, to solve homelessness, and to make things like childcare free. There was a brief period where we did support people. Everyone who didn't have a home in a lot of states, we put them up in accommodation. We fed them. We radically transformed the way society functioned. We did it in the context of a pandemic and the world didn't fall in. We kind of have demonstrated that, which I think is something positive to cling on to, because it does widen the space in terms of the kind of ideas and politics that we can test and fight over. I also think the other thing that's positive is the way that we all as people interacted and acted in order to save the people that we love. I think we did these things, most of us, not because we were scared of being fined or being sent to jail, but because we wanted to keep our community safe. And now seeing these reunions, seeing grandparents meet their grandchildren for the first time, seeing brothers and sisters reconnect is, I think, beautiful. This is what life is about. It's us working collectively to keep ourselves safe and enjoy those moments that make life worth living. So they're the good bits. I think my pessimism comes from the fact that some of the worst base instincts of Australians were exposed and preyed upon by politicians. The politicians on all sides of politics that were the most strict in terms of border controls, were the most harsh in terms of punishing or demonizing the most vulnerable, have now become the most popular. And that's not new. That's been a part of Australian politics for decades, since day one, basically. And, you know, we've seen it play out in immigration politics for the past few decades. And I do fear, unfortunately, Raf, that that is the lesson that our political leaders will take from this, is not the lesson that people are generous and willing to support each other, but that the easy option is to shut down borders, it's to demonize certain communities, and that's what will get you reelected. Unfortunately, I don't have a lot of faith in our politicians that they'll go beyond that. And I think that's why I'm a bit fearful, because the next crisis that hits, if it's that same game plan and they get reelected and they become popular on that, we will see the same thing happen. We will see the most vulnerable punished. And as Jamila said, those cracks will just get deeper.
The arch irony of a federal coalition that was harsh on borders being furious with Labor premiers for shutting borders. And I'll come to Norman in a moment, but climate change, we're talking in the lead up to Glasgow. It's the biggest collective issue threatening affecting humanity. Have we crept forward a bit? Has the pandemic response made us a bit more able to deal with the collective effort we need for climate change?
Well, it's interesting because I think on lines of what I was just saying, you can sort of see it potentially following the same script. I think Australian people, by and large, for a long time now, have been saying they're willing to do what it takes to combat climate change and to create a safe future for, you know, not just our generation, but future generations. But in terms of what Australia as like a political entity, as governments need to do, we need to be looking after our neighbours. We need to be accepting climate refugees. We need to be spending a lot of public money to not only build infrastructure here, but to support those around the world that will be suffering the brunt of this. We already know that in Australia, it's communities who are marginalized, communities in Western Sydney, where you know, heat waves are getting worse every year, communities in regional Australia who are suffering the brunt of this. And we're not doing that. And I think that's my fear, is that when this crisis gets worse, the climate crisis gets worse, the same thing will happen. We will see governments respond in a way to protect their base, to make those people feel safe, and we'll build up those walls. We won't accept climate refugees. We won't spend the money we need to protect the most vulnerable. And look, I hope that I'm wrong. I'm not saying this because I want it to happen, obviously, but just watching the last couple of years play out, I do feel worried that that's where we'll end up.
Norman Swan, take your pick. Pandemic, climate change, politics. How has our response prepared us for the next big challenge we face?
So we responded very well, probably amongst the best in the world, to HIV. And we've got a group of people together, an independent group of people together from different disciplines, different parts of the community, representing the gay community as well as others, and managed that pandemic really well. And we did not learn the lessons from that and did not apply it to this pandemic. And so, you know, past performance predicts future performance. We also, just picking up on what both Jamila and Osman have said, is that we respond much more acutely to what we see as urgent catastrophes rather than slow-moving catastrophes. So if we were to have learned from this, we would be responding differently to climate change, because climate change will dwarf COVID-19 in terms of its impact on people's health, well-being, deaths, social dislocation, and so on. And we have not responded to that, and neither political party has. So we don't really have a very effective opposition in Australia in terms of any of these issues. So I am pessimistic, unfortunately. I see us walking into a slow-moving train crash, and without the things that we need to have in place to make it happen, kind of know what needs to happen with the next pandemic. But I'm not sure it will. Already a year and a half into this, we've forgotten the lessons of last year. Already, in terms of how we've managed the current situation. You had the New South Wales government standing up and saying exactly the same things that Dan Andrews said at the beginning of wave two in Victoria, that he learned he shouldn't have said. And they made the same mistakes again. Unbelievable. And I just find,
so
I'm embarrassed.
So what those things, Norman? Can you expand on that, Norman? What are the things they said?
That's a micro example where they were blaming people from disadvantaged communities for their bad behavior and how we had to get tough with them, and et cetera, et cetera. It was almost word for word what was said in Victoria in the second wave, which alienated communities, which stopped getting them on side, which assumed they were watching the ABC every day and watching the press conferences when they weren't, and getting their information from other sources. And eventually they had to put people in on the ground doing community development to actually make it work. And New South Wales refused that help in this current outbreak. So, you know, that's just one small, it's a big example, but it's one example within the context of this pandemic where we haven't learned. So the one hope that we've got is the community remembers, and that our voices are heard.
Norman Swan's book is So You Think You Know What's Good For You. Osman Faruqi has the 7am podcast with Schwartz Media. Jamila Rizvi, her latest book is Work, Love, Body, Future Women. You can order them online at readings. Just before we go, 10 seconds to each of you, and really 10 seconds. What is the one thing that Osman Faruqi at the end of 2021 wants to tell the Osman Faruqi in March of 2020? Oz, you're sending a message back in time. You've got 10 seconds.
Never take for granted time with your family and the people you love ever, ever again, because you never know how hard it'll be when you can't see them.
Jamila, what 10-second message are you sending back in time to yourself?
Order the school holiday supplies 6 weeks before the school holiday is not the first day off.
Norman?
I'm with Osman, and I need sleep therapy. You get sleep therapy early. haven't had much sleep in the last 18 months.
No, my sleep's destroyed forever. I'm not sure it is ever coming back. It's been an absolute pleasure to speak to all three of you. I hope everybody enjoyed this episode of the podcast series from the Melbourne Writers Festival in 2021. Thank you all for being here.
Thanks for listening. To support Melbourne Writers Festival, you can make a donation of any size at mwf.com.au.